many, improbable. Suppose the story got about that I had pretended to be drunk. Suppose people did not all think it was pretense. I lurched up, the policeman half lifting me. I went along weakly and quietly for about 100 yards. The officer evidently thought that I was too sleepy and feeble to effect an escape, and so held me lightly and easily enough. Past one turning, two turnings, three turnings, four turnings, he trailed me with him, a limp and slow and reluctant figure. At the fourth turning, I suddenly broke from his hand and tore down the street like a maddened stag. He was unprepared, he was heavy, and it was dark. I ran and ran and ran, and in 5 minutes running found I was gaining. In half an hour I was out in the fields under the holy and blessed stars, where I tore off my accursed shawl and bonnet and buried them in clean earth. The old gentleman had finished his story and leaped back in his chair. Both the matter and the manner of his narration had, as time went on, impressed me favorably. He was an old duffer and pedant, but behind these things he was a country-bred man and gentleman, and had showed courage and a sporting instinct in the hour of desperation. He had told his story with many quaint formalities of diction, but also with a very convincing realism. "And now," I began. "And now," said Shorter, leaning forward again with something like servile energy, "and now, Mr. Swinburne, what about that unhappy man, Hawker? I cannot tell what those men meant, or how far what they said was real. But surely there is danger. I cannot go to the police for reasons that you perceive. Among other things, they wouldn't believe me. What is to be done?" I took out my watch. It was already 12:30. "My friend Basil Grant," I said, "is the best man we can go to. He and I were to have gone to the same dinner tonight, but he will just have come back by now. Have you any objection to taking a cab?" "Not at all," he replied, rising politely and gathering up his absurd plaid shawl. A rattle in a hansom brought us underneath the somber pile of workmen's flats in Lambeth, which Grant inhabited. A climb up a wearisome wooden staircase brought us to his garret. When I entered that wooden and scrappy interior, the white gleam of Basil's shirt front and the luster of his fur coat flung on the wooden settle struck me as a contrast. He was drinking a glass of wine before retiring. I was right. He had come back from the dinner party. He listened to the repetition of the story of the Reverend Ellis Shorter with the genuine simplicity and respect which he never failed to exhibit in dealing with any human being. When it was over, he said simply, "Do you know a man named Captain Fraser?" I was so startled at this totally irrelevant reference to the worthy collector of chimpanzees with whom I ought to have dined that evening that I glanced sharply at Grant. The result was that I did not look at Mr. Shorter. I only heard him answer, in his most nervous tone, "No." Basil, however, seemed to find something very curious about his answer, or his demeanor generally, for he kept his big blue eyes fixed on the old clergyman, and though the eyes were quite quiet, they stood out more and more from his head. "You are quite sure, Mr. Shorter," he repeated, "that you don't know Captain Fraser?" "Quite," answered the vicar, and I was certainly puzzled to find him returning so much to the timidity, not to say the demoralization, of his tone when he first entered my presence. Basil sprang smartly to his feet. "Then our course is clear," he said. "You have not even begun your investigation, my dear Mr. Shorter. The first thing for us to do is to go together to see Captain Fraser." "When?" asked the clergyman, stammering. "Now," said Basil, putting one arm in his fur coat. The old clergyman rose to his feet, quaking all over. "I really do not think that it is necessary," he said. Basil took his arm out of the fur coat, threw it over the chair again, and put his hands in his pockets. "Oh," he said with emphasis, "oh, you don't think it necessary, then." And he added the words with great clearness and deliberation. "Then, Mr. Ellis Shorter, I can only say that I would like to see you without your whiskers." And at these words I also rose to my feet, for the great tragedy of my life had come. Splendid and exciting as life was in continual contact with an intellect like Basil's, I had always the feeling that that splendor and excitement were on the borderland of sanity. He lived perpetually near the vision of the reason of things which makes men lose their reason. And I felt of his insanity as men feel of the death of friends with heart disease. It might come anywhere, in a field, in a hansom cab, looking at a sunset, smoking a cigarette. It had come now. At the very moment of delivering a judgment for the salvation of a fellow creature, Basil Grant had gone mad. "Your whiskers," he cried, advancing with blazing eyes. "Give me your whiskers and your bald head." The old vicar naturally retreated a step or two. I stepped between. "Sit down, Basil," I implored. "You're a little excited. Finish your wine." "Whiskers," he answered sternly. "Whiskers." And with that, he made a dash at the old gentleman, who made a dash for the door, but was intercepted. And then, before I knew where I was, the quiet room was turned into something between a pantomime and pandemonium by these two. Chairs were flung over with a crash. Tables were vaulted with a noise like thunder. Screens were smashed, crockery scattered in smithereens. And still, Basil Grant bounded and bellowed after the Reverend Ellis Shorter. And now I began to perceive something else, which added the last half-witted touch to my mystification. The Reverend Ellis Shorter of Chuntsey in Essex was by no means behaving as I had previously noticed him to behave, or as, considering his age and station, I should have expected him to behave. His power of dodging, leaping, and fighting would have been amazing in a lad of 17, and in this doddering old vicar looked like a sort of farcical fairy tale. Moreover, he did not seem to be so much astonished as I had thought. There was even a look of something like enjoyment in his eyes, so there was in the eye of Basil. In fact, the unintelligible truth must be told. They were both laughing. At length, Shorter was cornered. "Come, come, Mr. Grant," he panted. "You can't do anything to me. It's quite legal, and it doesn't do anyone the least harm. It's only a social fiction, a result of our complex society, Mr. Grant." "I don't blame you, my man," said Basil coolly, "but I want your whiskers and your bald head. Do they belong to Captain Fraser?" "No, no," said Mr. Shorter, laughing. "We provide them ourselves. They don't belong to Captain Fraser." "What the deuce does all this mean?" I almost screamed. "Are you all in an infernal nightmare? Why should Mr. Shorter's bald head belong to Captain Fraser? How could it? What the deuce has Captain Fraser to do with the affair? What is the matter with him? You dined with him, Basil." "No," said Grant, "I didn't." "Didn't you go to Mrs. Thornton's dinner party?" I asked, staring. "Why not?" "Well," said Basil, with a slow and singular smile, "the fact is I was detained by a visitor. I have him, as a point of fact, in my bedroom." "In your bedroom," I repeated, but my imagination had reached that point when he might have said in his coal scuttle or his waistcoat pocket. Grant stepped to the door of an inner room, flung it open, and walked in. Then he came out again with the last of the bodily wonders of that wild night. He introduced into the sitting room, in an apologetic manner, and by the nape of the neck, a limp clergyman with a bald head, white whiskers, and a plaid shawl. "Sit down, gentlemen," cried Grant, striking his hands heartily. "Sit down, all of you, and have a glass of wine. As you say, there is no harm in it, and if Captain Fraser had simply dropped me a hint, I could have saved him from dropping a good sum of money. Not that you would have liked that, eh?" The two duplicate clergymen who were sipping their burgundy with two duplicate grins laughed heartily at this, and one of them carelessly pulled off his whiskers and laid them on the table. "Basil," I said, "if you are my friend, save me. What is all this?" He laughed again. "Only another addition, cherub, to your collection of queer trades. These two gentlemen, whose health I have now the pleasure of drinking, are professional detainers." "And what on earth's that?" I asked. "It's really very simple, Mr. Swinburne," began he who had once been the Reverend Ellis Shorter of Chuntsey in Essex, and it gave me a shock indescribable to hear out of that pompous and familiar form come no longer its own pompous and familiar voice, but the brisk, sharp tones of a young city man. "It is really nothing very important. We are paid by our clients to detain in conversation, on some harmless pretext, people whom they want out of the way for a few hours. and Captain Fraser, and with that he hesitated and smiled. Basil smiled also, and he intervened. The fact is that Captain Fraser, who is one of my best friends, wanted us both out of the way very much. He is sailing tonight for East Africa, and the lady with whom we were all to have dined is, what I believe described as the romance of his life. He wanted that 2 hours with her, and employed these two reverend gentlemen to detain us at our houses so as to let him have the field to himself. And, of course, said the late Mr. Shorter apologetically to me, as I had to keep a gentleman at home from keeping an appointment with a lady, I had to come with something rather hot and strong, rather urgent. It wouldn't have done to be tame. Oh, I said, I acquit you of tameness. Thank you, sir, said the man respectfully. Always very grateful for any recommendation, sir. The other man idly pushed back his artificial bald head, revealing close red hair, and spoke dreamily, perhaps under the influence of Basil's admirable burgundy. It's wonderful how common it's getting, gentlemen. Our office is busy from morning till night. I've no doubt you've often knocked up against us before. You just take notice. When an old bachelor goes on boring you with hunting stories, when you're burning to be introduced to somebody, he's from our bureau. When a lady calls on parish work and stops hours, just when you wanted to go to the Robinsons, she's from our bureau. The Robinson hand, sir, may be darkly seen. There's one thing I don't understand, I said. Why are you both vicars? A shade crossed the brow of the temporary incumbent of Chuntsey in Essex. That may have been a mistake, sir, he said, but it was not our fault. It was all the munificence of Captain Fraser. He requested that the highest price and talent on our tariff should be employed to detain you gentlemen. Now, the highest payment in our office goes to those who impersonate vicars, as being the most respectable and more of a strain. We are paid 5 guineas a visit. We have had the good fortune to satisfy the firm with our work, and we are now permanently vicars. Before that, we had 2 years as colonels, and next in our scale, colonels are 4 guineas. Chapter 4. The Singular Speculation of the House Agent. Lieutenant Drummond Keith was a man about whom conversation always burst like a thunderstorm the moment he left the room. This arose from many separate touches about him. He was a light, loose person who wore light, loose clothes, generally white, as if he were in the tropics. He was lean and graceful, like a panther, and he had restless black eyes. He was very impecunious. He had one of the habits of the poor in a degree so exaggerated as immeasurably to eclipse the most miserable of the unemployed. I mean the habit of continually change of lodgings. There are inland tracts of London where, in the very heart of artificial civilization, humanity has almost become nomadic once more. But in that restless interior there is no ragged tramp so restless as the elegant officer in the loose white clothes. He had shot a great many things in his time, to judge from his conversation, from partridges to elephants, but his slangier acquaintances were of opinion that the moon had been, not infrequently, amid the victims of his victorious rifle. The phrase is a fine one and suggests a mystic, elfish, nocturnal hunting. He carried from house to house and from parish to parish a kit which consisted practically of 5 articles. 2 odd-looking, large-bladed spears tied together, the weapons, I suppose, of some savage tribe, a green umbrella, a huge and tattered copy of the Pickwick Papers, a big game rifle, and a large sealed jar of some unholy Oriental wine. These always went into every new lodging, even for one night, and they went in quite undisguised, tied up in wisps of string or straw, to the delight of the poetic gutter boys in the little gray streets. I had forgotten to mention that he always carried also his old regimental sword, but this raised another odd question about him. Slim and active as he was no longer very young. His hair, indeed, was quite gray, though his rather wild, almost Italian mustache retained its blackness, and his face was careworn under its almost Italian gaiety. To find a middle-aged man who has left the army at the primitive rank of lieutenant is unusual and not necessarily encouraging. With the more cautious and solid this fact, like his endless flirting, did the mysterious gentleman no good. Lastly, he was a man who told the kind of adventures which win a man admiration, but not respect. They came out of queer places where a good man would scarcely find himself, out of opium dens and gambling hells. They had the heat of the thieves' kitchens, or smelled of a strange smoke from cannibal incantations. These are the kind of stories which discredit a person almost equally, whether they are believed or no. If Keith's tales were false, he was a liar. If they were true, he had had, at any rate, every opportunity of being a scamp. He had just left the room in which I sat with Basil Grant and his brother Rupert, the voluble amateur detective. And as I say was invariably the case, we were all talking about him. Rupert Grant was a clever young fellow, but he had that tendency which youth and cleverness, when sharply combined, so often produce, a somewhat extravagant skepticism. He saw doubt and guilt everywhere, and it was meat and drink to him. I had often got irritated with this boyish incredulity of his, but on this particular occasion I am bound to say that I thought him so obviously right that I was astounded at Basil's opposing him, however banteringly. I could swallow a good deal, being naturally of a simple turn, but I could not swallow Lieutenant Keith's autobiography. "You don't seriously mean, Basil," I said, "that you think that that fellow really did go as a stowaway with Nansen and pretend to be the mad mullah and..." "He has one fault," said Basil thoughtfully, "or virtue, as you may happen to regard it. He tells the truth in too exact and bald a style. He is too veracious." "Oh, are you going to be paradoxical?" said Rupert contemptuously. "Be a bit funnier than that. Say, for instance, that he has lived all his life in one ancestral manner." "No, he's extremely fond of change of scene," replied Basil dispassionately, "and of living in odd places. That doesn't prevent his chief trait being verbal exactitude. What you people don't understand is that telling a thing crudely and coarsely, as it happened, makes it sound frightfully strange. The sort of things Keith recounts are not the sort of things that a man would make up to cover himself with honor. They are too absurd. But they are the sort of things that a man would do if he were sufficiently filled with the soul of skylarking." "So far from paradox," said his brother, with something rather like a sneer, "you seem to be going in for journalese proverbs. Do you believe that truth is stranger than fiction?" "Truth must of necessity be stranger than fiction," said Basil placidly, "for fiction is the creation of the human mind and therefore is congenial to it." "Well, your lieutenant's truth is stranger, if it is truth, than anything I ever heard of," said Rupert, relapsing into flippancy. "Do you, on your soul, believe in all that about the shark and the camera?" "I believe Keith's words," answered the other. "He is an honest man." "I should like to question a regiment of his landladies," said Rupert cynically. "I must say I think you can hardly regard him as unimpeachable merely in himself," I said mildly. "His mode of life..." Before I could complete the sentence, the door was flung open, and Drummond Keith appeared again on the threshold, his white panama on his head. "I say, Grant," he said, knocking off his cigarette ash against the door, "I've got no money in the world till next April. Could you lend me £100? That's a good chap." Rupert and I looked at each other in an ironical silence. Basil, who was sitting by his desk, swung the chair around idly on its screw and picked up a quill pen. "Shall I cross it?" he asked, opening a checkbook. "Really," began Rupert with a rather nervous loudness, "since Lieutenant Keith has seen fit to make this suggestion to Basil before his family, I..." "Here you are, ugly," said Basil, fluttering a check in the direction of the quite nonchalant officer. "Are you in a hurry?" "Yes," replied Keith in a rather abrupt way. "As a matter of fact, I want it now. I want to see my businessman. Rupert was eyeing him sarcastically, and I could see that it was on the tip of his tongue to